This is the fourth Paul Farmer Aviation podcast, and my guest today is Jean-Pierre Calmon. We were colleagues together in Martinair when he was a 747 captain and I was flying the MD-11. In Martinair, everybody always referred to Jean-Pierre as JP. Is that okay, JP?
That's fully okay.
Okay. <Yeah. laughs> Welcome to the Paul Farmer Aviation podcast.
Thank you very much.
You started your career in aviation as a fighter pilot, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. How long was that ago? What year?
Yeah, I started on the military academy in 1978, so 4 years later I started flying 1981, 1982.
Yeah,
started
okay.
my pilot training in Shepard Air Force Base.
On the F-16?
No, on the T-37, T-38.
Oh, of course, yeah. What did they call it again? The Tweety Bird?
The Tweety Bird.
Yeah.
Or the noise converter. it was fuel to noise converter.
Yeah, yeah. It was a Cessna, right?
Cessna.
A dual seater. Yeah. You were sitting right next to each other with a low wing. Yeah, I remember seeing it when I was doing my flight training in the States. So, and then from there you progressed to the F-16.
Yeah, from T-37, T-38. T-38 is a fast jet, like an F-5.
Oh, yeah.
The training version. And then in the Netherlands you got a conversion course scenario and conversion course to the NF-5. And then after 2.5, 3 years, I went to the F-16.
Okay. So how many years did you fly the F-16?
9 years, almost 9 years.
And then you left the military to...
Yeah, I applied with KLM and Martinair in 1994, June 94, and I was approved into KLM and Martinair, and I chose for Martinair.
Okay, that's a bit unusual, isn't it? Everybody would always say, well, you know, KLM is the highest achievement you can get, the best job, blah, blah, blah.
No, for me, it was actually, I was head of flight operations, Airbase Twente at that moment, or deputy. So I flew already around for 12 years, and I had to become a secondary officer within KLM.
Okay, yeah.
And Martinair just said to me, well, we think within 6 years you might be a captain here, and you can choose what you want to fly. So
was
I
it
became
6 years
a first officer.
Was it 6 years before you became a captain in Martinair?
No, I think it was 2 years and 10 months.
Really? Yeah?
Yeah.
I thought I did as fast in five years, but you did.
Yeah, but I was an old fart when I arrived there. I was almost 34 years old. So
now, the fascinating thing about your career is when you went to the Royal Military Academy, you studied sociology and psychology, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
You did a bachelor in that. I saw that on your resume. I found that kind of unusual for somebody who was entering in a really, to my understanding, a little bit of a macho world. The aviation world is a, you know, the fighter pilot world. You know, everybody thinks of fighter pilots, Top Guns, Tom Cruise, and those are egos, you know. But you, that's the reason why I invited you here, to talk about the, you know, let's say the soft skills, the no-techs, the non-technical skills of aviation. Crew resource management, because when you finished with Martinair, you were a chief pilot on the 747, right?
Yes.
Then you retired, and then you started your own company?
Actually, it was a little bit earlier. I stopped management about 1.5 years before I retired.
Okay.
And that has had everything to do with the takeover from KLM and discharging pilots. And then I said, okay.
Yeah, what year was that? 2014, 15?
14, and I started my own business in December 2015.
Yeah. And what the business you're in, what is it? Can you explain the list to the listeners?
Yeah, I think we are in the business of, let's put it like this. We started off to increase patient safety in hospitals. That was the first mission, actually. And then when I joined Human Factors, I said, why do we stop only at hospitals and why don't we bring it to all high reliability organizations?
Yeah.
Because crisis management or high quality decision making is necessary in high risk operations, high risk organizations. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if it's about money or lives. For somebody, crisis is an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at it. So the decision if you are going to spend $5 million or $2,000 or make a critical decision about how to deploy a boat for the Coast Guard, they're all critical decisions personally. It's a personal critical decision.
Okay.
So, yeah.
But that's what I wanted to get into in this podcast. You did a TEDx talk, right? And the topic was, what if healthcare embraced just culture?
Yes.
How long ago was it that this spark flew across from the aviation, communication culture, crew resource management? Let's scroll back a little bit. Can you, to the listener, explain what crew resource management entails, what it means?
It's not simple. No. It's a very complex method, I think, or philosophy. But when I talk about it, I talk about the Western European form of CRM, because there's also a cultural factor. But I don't want to go into that. But what it entails for me is that you will always try to make optimum use of your team.
Yeah, exactly.
And you need insights in how team dynamics work and what influences the quality of your decision making. Mm-hmm. In relation to what you just asked about my TED talk, what I found out when we started crew resource management training in healthcare, in hospitals, I thought, well, what I see here is that people would like to embrace CRM, but there is no just culture. Within healthcare.
What is just culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. The definition is actually, you can bring it down to three things, and that is there's no naming, blaming, and shaming.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for me, what I found out in the last 8 years is it started off with CRM, then I incorporated CRM, and then I incorporated just culture. I thought there's no way CRM will work if there's no just culture. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing came up, and it was because a friend of mine, she is head of learning and development for McKinsey. She said, yeah, but JP, you're not only busy with just culture, you are busy with psychological safety and sociological safety.
Yeah.
And I think that is the big connection between those three things. You need psychological safety, you need just culture, and you need CRM. And then you will get best decision making.
Do you have any idea when it was the first time that actually this idea was transported into the medical world, this teaching of CRM and just culture? How long ago was this?
Well, I think the first book that really had an impact is in a book by American authors, and I think they were from Berkeley, Harvard, and it was called Beyond the Checklist.
Okay.
And that book described how many wrong medicine descriptions there were in the United States, how many mistakes were made, and human mistakes.
How many?
Yeah, there were a lot. I don't know those numbers
thousands.
Anymore. Yeah, thousands, yes.
But, the United States is a big country. Let's keep it down to our little postage stamp Holland. I remember a few years ago, and this was the low end of the estimate, that some 1,700 people died in hospitals.
On operation tables.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the OR. Yeah.
Due to human error?
No, that's not what the statistics say.
Okay.
They say they die there.
Okay.
And the thing is, of course, that I know for sure that CRM will increase safety in an OR, in a cockpit. We all know that. And what the numbers are is very hard to say, because when you change something technical, early warning indicators, when you change that in good cooperation with CRM, it improves incredible.
Yeah,
the safety level will improve. So it's very hard to just point certain increases in numbers and better statistics just to CRM.
Yeah.
I know for sure that CRM is good for safety. CRM is good for efficiency, and it's also good because it increases work satisfaction. Mm-hmm. When people are involved in decision making, they feel involved in the company, the organization, and you get less people getting sick at home.
That's true. You know, the funny thing is, earlier you said something about the Western European culture. I worked for 6 years for a major airline in the Near East, where basically people, one first officer one night pointed out to me, they have an Asian mindset, and their culture is one of always deferral, always having to give respect, and always having to bow down to somebody who was higher in rank than you. They could never just call me Herman. There always had to be a rank prefix. It always had to be Captain Herman or Herman Sir, or the Turkish word for master is Hocam. And they felt completely uncomfortable if they let that prefix out.
Yeah.
They could not just say Herman, you know. And this was bred into their culture, and their culture was also one of preserving the ego at all times. You know, a debriefing was a very awkward thing, because then they felt sometimes personally attacked, which I always, in a very circumstantial way, try to explain. I'm not personally attacking you. I'm taking one thing out of the whole equation where something went wrong that we could have done better, or you could have done better, or maybe you should pay attention or heed that. And they would just, you know, bow their heads and like I just completely blew them out of the water, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is such an incredible, strange thing about different cultures. You cannot change a culture, an Asian culture, that has been in place for thousands of years, maybe, you know. I always find that in for CRM, I'm not trying to sound off, but I think the Dutch culture, the way we are so egalitarian in many mm-hmm. ways, almost disrespectful the way we talk to elder people, you know. You go across the border into Germany or Belgium, you don't even dream about starting with somebody on a first name basis. So I think we have a good breeding ground for CRM in this country. What do you think?
I totally agree. The Dutch culture is a very good base to have a participative leadership, to have a very shallow gradient in the cockpit.
Exactly.
Or in a board. But I think the way EASA is trying to teach us how to deal with cultural differences in cockpits or in boardrooms, it doesn't matter, is a very good way. They use Hofstede Insights. I don't know if you know that, but I really like that. And when you see...
What does that mean?
Yeah, Hofstede is a Dutch professor, and the way he looks at and distinguishes different cultures mm-hmm. on six aspects. For example, power distance index. Is your culture agreeing with the big difference in power? Mm-hmm. You will see that Russia will score very high, mm-hmm. and in the Netherlands we score low.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, and what EASA says, if you are putting two different cultures in a cockpit, how do you overcome that? Because you cannot say something to somebody, turn off your culture. Mm-hmm. For example, Far East,
exactly.
People don't ask questions. Because if they ask questions, they might show vulnerability or they lose a statue or that. So what you need to do is you need to understand what the difference is between those two cultures, and then tell everybody what the common goal is of your mission.
Yeah.
The common goal is to land safe in B when you depart from A. And then you tell people that in the Netherlands, we want you to ask questions. We want you to speak about stuff or speak up about stuff.
Yeah.
So in that case, for your example, when you ask in Turkey what you mentioned, and you say to somebody, okay, can you tell me what happened there? Mm-hmm. You might have to add, for me to learn something, I'm going to ask you a question. What made you come to this decision in that situation?
Yeah.
And because I want to learn from you. And they probably don't like that, because they think, but you should know everything.
Yeah.
And they might lose some respect. But mm-hmm. if you say, that's the way how we operate within KLM or Martinair or Transavia, whatever, that will really enlighten people to start working like that.
Yeah.
It will not change their culture, but change the way we communicate.
I experienced that firsthand as a route training instructor. You know, I took the young co-pilots by the hand. They came from the flying school. They've spent 2 years flying a 737. You know, ab initio pilots, basically. You know, that's not an easy step. You know, a 737 is not that easy an airplane. Then they came to the 777. We fly long haul. And, you know, you'd kind of take them under your wings and explain that situation to them, you know, the CRM, and the company was transitioning into what they, you know, we would now call just culture. You know, you don't lop somebody's head off because he's made a mistake. They used to do that in the past, not too distant past. But then in the present, they are more and more seeing that, you know, under just culture, you can ask somebody, you know, what happened there? We are not going to lop your head off. We're not going to crush you or fire you or anything, but tell us what happened, you know, and come forward with it so we can all learn from it. That's just culture, right? The funny thing is those kids, they really embraced it. They loved it because I also gave them responsibilities, which they never got because the hierarchy in the cockpit was so huge. There was such a big gradient. Because the old guard, it made me think back of 1995, 96, when in Martinair we started to introduce CRM, basically. Yeah, training was picking up, and we were getting a couple of times a year a sit down with a British company that did fantastic trainings then.
Yeah.
And you noticed I was a young guy. I was mid-20s, and the old guard, the old DC-10 captains, and that went to the MD-11 later when the DC-10 disappeared, they had a hard time dealing with this. They did not want to embrace it. They were all like, you know, what is this BS? We don't need this. This is, you know, we are good as it is. And people hate change, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I looked at it and I thought, this is the way forward. This is how it should be. And you could see it at work, and you could see it paying off, right?
Yeah.
And so when I was in Turkey, basically, they are making the same transition, just later. And
yes,
they are growing into that. And the old guard is like, yeah, well, you know, now all of a sudden I have to be vulnerable and talk about my mistakes, blah, 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 blah. And that is very hard to do when your culture is all based on preserving the ego.
Yeah, but I think the way you break through that glass ceiling of culture that might stop you, or the way you were trained, is by really giving people insights and let them figure it out themselves. So if I would ask those old guys when I came into Martinair in 94, when I was 34 years old, I never forget the first classroom session. There was a very old classic captain, Steve, the trainer, said, so who's the best pilot in the cockpit? And he straight up said, that's me. Because I know Jeppesen the best. I have 18,000 hours.
Yeah.
And I started laughing because I thought he made a joke.
Yeah.
So he said to me, why are you laughing? You're only here for 6 months now, yeah, or seven, yeah, or 2 years, or whatever. Yeah. And I said, well, because I thought you started to make a joke. No, I didn't make a joke. And I said, well, but don't you agree that when we are with two people in the room, or three people, or four people, we have more information than only one people, one guy, one person? And he said, sure. I said, so why don't you think that your co-pilot could help you? And then he was quiet.
Yeah, really.
So
yeah,
it's the same thing that, you asked me about the macho world in the Air Force. In the beginning, you think you know it all. And then what happened to us, the F-16 happened. And the F-16 showed us, because we videotaped our head-up display and we heard ourselves talk and speak up over the different radios, and we saw our mistakes, and then we were forced to talk about our mistakes.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, what we do with Yes Human Factors is... We try to help organizations to come to better decision making, have less stress, more work, joy, by looking at it from a organizational transition. It's never an MBA in one day. It's always a process.
Exactly.
And the thing is that if you really want to change your organization culture, there's only two things that can help. And the first thing that will accelerate it is a crisis that will accelerate the change. And if you don't want to depend on crisis, the other option is good leadership. So you need good organizational leadership, a good mission, a good strategy, good vision, and then the culture will change.
Somebody at the top needs to realize that change is necessary.
Yeah, but also people on the work floor, because I regard an old captain, like I'm almost 64 years old, but when, let's say, 7 years ago, I had some colleagues of my age who didn't want to change anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that if you would ask me, let's say I'm all against change. I know why I'm against change, because I think that's how I was brought up. When procedures change, the chance of a failure or a mistake or an error or a lapse is bigger. And we were always trained, don't make mistakes, because exactly. it might kill you.
Yeah.
And that's the same in healthcare. Yeah, they're also trained, also don't make mistakes, because the consequences can be horrendous, right? When I would ask one of my fellow old guys, what did it look like 6 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago? A lot has changed.
Yeah.
So we all embrace those changes already, but we just don't want to admit it, that change is good or might be good.
Well, I think that's what keeps you alive, actually.
Exactly.
Because not changing means you're stuck in your little rut, and then you know, you're going to be surprised at one moment. You're going to be baffled or overrun, right? So I wanted to get back to that just culture. You know, it's the opposite of a blame culture, mm-hmm. just culture, right? This morning I read in the newspaper that a famous talk show host was going to return to the television. You you heard about this guy, right? He got basically tarred and feathered and carried off the stage 2 years ago because he had temper tantrums and yelling mm-hmm. at people, you know, a very perfectionistic attitude. And yeah, in our job, in our culture, in the flying world, we would look at a person like that and think, well, that's indeed not very grown up way of dealing with your colleagues who are all trying to do their best too.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's making a return now, but that was a typical, if you ask me, a typical example of a blame culture. And he, in fact, in the end, got to blame himself big time because he got booted out as mm-hmm. a television personality.
Yeah,
he was floored because they found out, some people started to complain, I refuse to be yelled and screamed at and be made an idiot out of. That's the blame culture, and that's the total opposite of what we have in aviation. But you have transposed that also into the medical realm, right?
Yeah.
How does that work, those trainings, when you actually sit down with people that are working in a surgery theater, in an operations theater, right?
Most of the time we train operations personnel. Mm-hmm. We also had a child part of where children were cured in a hospital that happened once. But most of the time it's ORs, OR personnel. So in rather big hospitals, we talk about 200 to 300 people.
Yeah, group that you need to train.
Yes.
That many.
Yeah, that many, yeah. So that's surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, recovery nurses, but up to people who are just looking at the patients after the operation as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole, actually it's the whole department exactly. that we train.
How did they, when you first came to do that, how many years ago did you have your first crew of one of those operating theaters?
I think it was March 16, something like that, April 16. I started December 15, and 4 months later we were training in The Hague in a big hospital.
Okay, and were they open to it?
Yes. I think, and it's also because the way we approach it. We have, a high-quality product. And the way we approach it is not that we are going to tell you how to do your job, mm-hmm. but we're going to tell you what we learned in the last 38, 50, or 40 years at that time with CRM in aviation and in aerospace, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's more than that. That takes away the threat. The other thing that really helped us was that we do it scientifically proven and that JP flew F-16 and has a good story. That worked. Yeah. That was a USP. So that combination of my colleague from Technical University.
That's Han Vermeer, right?
Han van der Meer, yeah. And his study in organizational development and change. And his knowledge about Siemens Academy that he founded. So it's that combination. Because...
What is Siemens Academy?
Yeah, the Siemens, the Netherlands, were losing. That's how.
Oh, you mean the German Siemens conglomerate?
Yeah. Big company.
Yeah.
And he founded the Siemens Academy, all about competence management and all that.
Okay.
So, and that combination from
and
him.
Han is your partner, right?
It's my partner. Yeah. So I think, first of all, we were found by a surgeon who asked for us. Mm-hmm. So he introduced us.
He discovered that something needed to change.
Yeah, he was at very simple at the hockey field, and he was standing next to Jaap van Leggelo, and he said, I want to know, how do you do that with competence measurement assessments? How do you deal with mistakes?
Yeah.
And he said, you have to talk to JP.
Okay.
So that's how he came with us. We had lunch with him and he said, we need this. Yeah. We really need this in the hospital. And it's very funny, actually, that 6 weeks ago I did a lecture for, he retired, and he invited me to do a lecture. And he said, go all out. You can say whatever you want. Really? And this old fellow.
What hospital was this?
The one in The Hague? I don't name.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. I should.
No, it was in The Hague. But
okay. Yeah, okay. But anyway, back by now they are turned around. They have embraced it. They are seeing the use of it.
Yeah, of course, they all see the use of it. Yeah. But I wanted to make some additional remarks with that, because for me, I get we are in oil and gas, Coast Guard, aviation, IT, everywhere, finance, where it's critical, where critical decisions are made. And for me, hospitals are one of the most complex organizations there are. Really, it's very complex. But the thing is that healthcare in hospitals has the same focus point for people as aviation. If something happens, it's in the news, right? Yeah. I don't know what the English word is, but is it sort of Damocles? Is it Damocles?
Yeah.
It's the same, right?
Yeah.
So it's media.
Exactly. Yeah.
The feedback from passengers or patients is
always hangs
away.
Over your head.
Yeah, it hangs over
and
your
it
head.
It comes down and it. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we approach this whole process of safety, patient safety in healthcare the same as what we do in aviation, and it is. Nobody comes to the hospital in the morning to say, today I'm going to make a big up.
Screw up. Yeah,
a screw up. Yeah. They're not nobody's like that. And they work their butt off.
Yeah.
Workload is high. Stress is high. Mm-hmm. And it's all because there is more patients, less money, less personnel. For them, it is very hard to change because there's not that much time for training.
No.
So do I have an opinion about healthcare? Yeah, sure. But it is... It is very hard to be objective about it because it is always personal.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see, what I would change besides the just culture, take that sword of Damocles away and protect those people.
Yeah,
protect them with a just
because
culture.
That's what your TEDx talk was about. What if they would embrace just culture? Are they doing that? Are they protecting or are they still blaming?
Well...
Probably per hospital is probably different, right?
Every hospital is different.
Yeah.
But I know that everybody understands that it should be better. And but it also has to do with rules and regulation and the influence of the insurance companies who pay for the healthcare or deliver the healthcare.
They should actually be demanding a training like that.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Because, you know, for the listeners to realize what is involved here, if you don't get into just culture and... you know, embracing your failures as learning moments, but you embrace blame culture and blaming people and chopping their head off for making a mistake. And what happens is people will bury their mistakes. They will never come forward with it if at any given chance they can, you know, avoid being detected by having screwed up.
Yes.
Then they will bury it deep. And that's, you know, people never learn, right? If you don't come up with your own mistakes and stand up and say, okay, yeah, well, I screwed up. And that takes guts, you know. That's making yourself vulnerable. You stand there undressed and then you say, well, I remember the first time I did this when I, during a flight, I made a really poor judgment call. Nothing bad happened, but I was so pissed off with myself. I was so completely disappointed with how I performed that I couldn't talk about it. I was just a young captain. I couldn't talk about it for a day. And the next night we were sitting in the crew van to the airport and I finally summed up the courage to start and talk about it. Then my co-pilot said, I thought about this, and I said, well, why for Christ's sake didn't you say something? Because it would have given me that nudge to get out of this stupid train of thought that I was in. Yeah, well, we all walked away from it. And then I got angry because I realized the whole crew teamwork fell apart, right? I made a bad decision. And he saw it happening, but he didn't do anything.
Yeah. It's very interesting what you just said, because earlier you mentioned this host on television, right?
Yeah.
Who's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I never forgot when there was a documentary coming out about a company in the Netherlands about exceeding boundaries in a big television company, yeah. Right, a production company. Yeah. And the reaction is from the big CEO was, these women should speak up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with this television host, it was also, but people should speak up. His colleagues should have spoken up.
Yeah.
Now you hear it, you should say something, mm-hmm. right? And for me, I've seen a colleague crash into the Alps, and later they found out after investigation he was tired.
This was in the military.
In the military, and he was tired, and the stress level was too low. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it was too easy, the exercise we flew. Okay. And so everybody said, but why didn't he say something that he was tired? And that was my first initial impulsive reaction as well. But a couple of years later, when I was flying in the F-16, suddenly it hit me. It has nothing to do with saying, or you shouldn't say, why didn't he say something? The thing is, why didn't I create an atmosphere in which he would speak up?
Yeah.
So, and that's the same with that big boss, one of the richest guys in the Netherlands, when he said, but those women should speak up. Mm-hmm. I agree with what he means, but the thing is, and it's a totally different...
They never felt able to.
Exactly. So the thing is, the organization should create an atmosphere where people dare to speak about or speak up. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the definition of speak up, for me, it's very easy. It has everything to do with being vulnerable.
Yeah.
So on the one side of the spectrum, you will have people who say, it doesn't feel good. And on the other side of the spectrum, you say, can you give me feedback?
Yeah.
How did I do? Mm-hmm. And everything in between is speak up behavior for me.
Yeah.
And the thing is, of course, that if you look at the investigation that just came out a couple of days ago about the atmosphere in hospitals, about hierarchy, the way people communicate, directive, if you talk about exceeding boundaries or something, that's what needs to be changed.
Yeah.
That's the first thing you need to change.
Is it a sexist environment?
Well, I don't know. I remember that one of the guys who investigated, he's a gynecologist, a surgeon, and he said there's an increasing number of females entering medical specialism, mm-hmm. so that way it might change.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to wait on that.
No.
You need to do something right now. No. So when I did this talk a couple of weeks ago, I talked about, it's a very good book by Amy Edmondson. She's a professor from Harvard Business School. And she's written a book, Fearless Organizations. And in that book, she uses an example about a specialist nurse walking with a doctor on the neonatology department of a hospital. Twin is born 7 weeks too early, and she thinks now he's going to prescribe these medication. And the moment she wants to speak up, she doesn't do it. So she is interviewed why she didn't say it. Yeah, she didn't say anything, and then her explanation was, well, 2 weeks ago I saw this same doctor telling a colleague of mine not to interfere with medication because that's his job. So I told it to all these surgeons, and I said, so how did I, in a cockpit, make sure that nobody ever had that feeling? Because what we just talked about before we went up here, 4 or maybe 9 out of 10 people, 4 out of 5, will choose their personal benefit, egoistic, mm-hmm. instead of the benefit for the patients, group. The organization, or the group. So what I told them, I said, why don't you ask 3 times the question, what? Just ask the nurse, when you walk up there, what do you see? She gives you her facts. Then you give your facts. You both might learn something. Then you say, what is your analysis? What is your diagnosis? Then you give yours. 2 people learn. And then you say, what do you suggest? And then she said, well, I would think about this medication. And then you can say, that's a good point, but now we don't need that yet. That we'll do that when the BP is lower
basically
than this.
Basically the same what we're doing in the cockpit all the time.
That's what I do in the cockpit. And they just said, yeah, that's very simple. And I said, what you do then is you involve people in decision-making. Mm-hmm. That makes them more happy, gives them more job satisfaction. You teach them or you learn something. And you come to a combined decision.
And you require them to think.
Yeah.
to.
And that means that the next day, if they don't know this day, the next day they will know.
Yeah.
So it's win-win-win. It's one plus one is three now.
Exactly.
And they later at the wine or at the beach, when we had a wine, a farewell wine, they said, five or six people said, that's so simple. And I don't like tricks, but it's a very, very,
very effective.
Trick. Yeah, very effective.
And that's you know, that's what I always found out when, you know, giving route training to these people. You know, you saw that they were basically not challenged in their job because there was such a big gradient between the captain and the co-pilot that the captain a lot of times took decisions solo, and then he said, looking around the group, saying, yes, like you all agree, right? And then everybody nodded, yeah, sure, you know. There was no involvement. They were not participating. And that was, it was very rewarding to take them by the hand and to teach them, you know, you have a responsibility too. You are going to fly this leg. What do you want? Mm. How much fuel do you want? Are you sure you want that? Think about it. Well, why don't you really think about the fuel figure do you want? Because where are we going? The weather is not so nice. And maybe, you know, we have a high consumer airplane that's all old and bent and whatever. And then they all of a sudden, you saw the lights go on. And it was was very rewarding. By the way, we're going to take a little break now. Okay, so we continue. The trainings, JP, that you give to these surgery or operation theaters, you use a flight simulator for that, right?
Yes.
Which any a generic one or a specific type of airplane or?
No, because I only understand 74 or 737. It's a 737 which was available. Yeah, the thing is that maybe some additional remarks before I go into that. First of all, aviation is way ahead of all other industries in CRM. And it's not because we are so good or smart. It's because rulemaking and laws tell us to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's a big advantage for us.
Well, the road to that success has been paved by countless deaths. You know?
Exactly. I mean,
you know, everybody always, you know, we start at the beginning somewhere in the 70s, you know, the TriStar with Eastern Airlines that flew into the Everglades, perfectly functioning. The KLM 74 Pan Am, you know, disaster. Something I want to talk about later, not about that disaster, but a certain mindset of pilots. But we'll get into that later.
Yeah.
But that is.
So for me, that's what people need to understand. We are not that good, and we are not macho that we are so good at CRM. But at this moment, we are in the ninth generation of development of CRM. It's around for 45 years, something like that. So it's even older than sales CRM, customer relations management.
Yeah.
That's only around for 30 years, maybe.
Yeah, we started somewhere with, what was it? The James Reason Swiss cheese model.
Yes,
and now we are at threat and error management and any new developments there.
And cultural differences is mandatory. Yeah. So what we do is we give people insights about the scientific basics of CRM in the broader sense. It's about the dirty dozen or dirty 13, like startling surprise, communication, stress, etc. And then, of course, we enter a hospital where people are almost at the same level of professionalism as pilots, and maybe even more professional. But they are in high-tech environment where group dynamics really decide the quality, what the quality is of the decision-making. So, and there's hierarchy. And in our case, we make it even easier in aviation. We put four stripes, three stripes, two stripes, or one stripe on somebody's shoulder, so to make it obvious who's the boss. Mm-hmm. And then we are going to talk about CRM in a hospital, and we talk about just culture. That is when we use aviation as a metaphor. So the flight simulator we use as a metaphor. You can also go sailing or mountain climbing. It doesn't matter. But what we do actually is we force people to understand that two, three, four people know more than one. And we also show that we have biases. That when the captain looks at instruments or displays, he might see different things than the co-pilot. and he might miss things. Yes. And then we can also use the flight simulator to prove that just culture works, because you make a mistake. Yeah. So how does this work? What we do is we give a 40-minute lesson in a very bad way. I teach people how the autopilot works, and I tell them on forehand, the way I'm going to tell you now the theory about how the autopilot works is the worst way I can teach you, because you're going to forget 70% of what I'm telling you. I'm giving you so much information that when you're sitting in the cockpit, you need each other. I force you to ask each other questions. Okay, makes sense? And everybody's like, yeah, sure. Then we tell them how the autopilot works, how the different buttons work, how they are working together. And I tell them, you need to remember this and don't forget this. Then we get into the simulator and I tell them again, I show them, this is how the heading select button works or how the speed button works. And everybody goes, okay, let's start. And then the scenario is we're flying at 12,000 feet above the Water Niles. Both pilots didn't follow the rules and they ate the same food and they got food poisoning. And these people volunteered to help out. Nobody knows that you're there. And then only the purser, and then the exercise starts. And I say, okay, are you ready to start the exercise? They say, yes. And then I start in English, I move back and I say, okay, KLM 123, turn right heading 270. And almost at the same time, it's stress.
Really?
Yeah, the same, because you speak English and they start touching knobs, they start doing things, they start in the action mode. Mm. So that's what happens. And everybody starts making mistakes. And then the scenario is really built that I stop the simulator when I think, now there's a learning moment, there's a situation where we can ask questions, and they will never forget it. So it's a one-hour simulator, then they go back into the classroom, then we do another scenario.
How many are in the sim?
A maximum of 3 or 4. Mm. And I changed it. The second flight is 1 hour later, and then they will end up with making a manual landing next to me and a successful landing. So
They will be flying. You're the pilot monitoring, so to speak.
Yes, and I help.
Assistant.
Of course. So the thing is, they learn a lot in 2 times 1 hour, and the scenario the second time is more complex. It has to do with smoke, for example, in the cabin. And then they see that they are interdependent with each other. They cannot do it on their own. Mm-hmm. That hierarchy has nothing to do. It has to do with who remembers what I just said, who dares to ask a proper question. Mm-hmm. Who dares to speak up and say, hey guys, I'm stressed. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And you can actually show it that it will work. And then they can, and then after the second session, we let them make the comparison to their own OR room in the hospital. And they all see it. So sometimes you see
on the other hand, when they are in the OR room, most of them, they know what they're going to do there. They know what they're doing.
That's true. But if you look at where the mistakes are made in high reliability organizations where incidents happen or even accidents, it's not in abnormal situations. It's not in high stress. It's almost most of the time
simple daily routine things. Yeah, really?
Yeah. If you look at a big RIVM report, 15 years of dangerous goods in Botlek area. Mm-hmm. It's always routine operations where the deaths, where fatalities came around.
Complacency.
It's complacency. It is low stress.
Mm-hmm. People are not exactly on the edge of their seat.
No focus or less focus or I can do it without my helmet, for example.
Exactly.
Those things.
Yeah.
It's floppy. It's the same like in aviation. Mm-hmm. Complacency within yourself or complacency towards your colleague.
Yeah,
I'm flying with Bell Farmer and he always makes a good landing. Mm-hmm. I've had it with a colleague who, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but he was an asshole captain because he always made beautiful landings. didn't matter what the weather conditions or runway conditions were. Uh-huh. And for the first time, landing at 10 o'clock at night, 18 right at that moment, was not three runways to the south. Coming back on day 12 from Tenerife, wind 1805 knots, beautiful visibility, cavalcade, and I relaxed and I crossed my arms and I was sitting next to him.
You were the FO, you were the first officer.
I was the first officer in pilot monitoring. And at 500 feet, 500 checked, and at 50, 40, 30, and nothing happened. And I could just slam the thrust levers forward. I called flare, and we made a positive touchdown, not a hard landing, and he said, shit. I slept. And he was in a microsleep.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Now we know that it happens, that it might happen.
Yeah.
Day 12.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was complacent, expecting him to make the beautiful landing, because he always does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So first time in my life, I crossed my arms. Yeah.
And you get slapped on the nose right away. Eh?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The funny thing is, I noticed that when I started as a first officer, that I was always feeling sorry for them, the DC-10 and the 7-4 captains. You saw them in the Middle East. There was no, they got a telex under the door, but actually back then they didn't get a telex under the door. Every 2-3 hours, you had to walk down and see if there was a new telex with an ETA.
Exactly.
There were no wake up calls. There were no messages on your iPhone. There was no iPhone, and these guys were always tired.
Yeah.
Because they didn't sleep. They were just turning around in their bed and then, oh, let's go downstairs, have a look at that telex. You know, there was no service from the company that way. So I remember these guys, and to me, they always looked perpetually tired.
Mm.
And the first thing they always said, getting in that crew van, did you get some rest? I said, yeah, I slept for 3 hours. Good. And then you saw them go like, okay, that's good. And the funny thing was, I've always done that my entire career. I get into the van with the crew. A night flight back from whatever, Miami or Houston, back to Amsterdam or Istanbul, whatever.
Yeah,
I would always ask them, "Did you get some rest? Did you, you know, just to get a feeling of if somebody is awake, if he's or she is sharp, right?"
Yeah.
So you're in the simulator, and then you're doing a debriefing after that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then how often do you train these people? Are you going back a half a year later to see if, have a follow-up plan?
Well, the thing is, of course, that, like I said earlier, we are coming in to change a culture. That's our intention. So we do it with the philosophy of how do we change organizational cultures. And that means that you will have to, like we do in aviation, that's very good. You can expect drift. So if you do not get a recurrent, there will be drift.
Of course.
I see that with
drift, you mean a deterioration.
Deterioration of your knowledge, of your skills. It will,
of course.
It will disappear. So that's why we have it 3 times a year in an exam, or 1 time in a classroom per year. And all these subjects are coming back after 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because everybody knows that if you're not told how something works for 7 times, you will forget.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure that this drift doesn't happen. In hospitals, they train once. There's no law who says you have to do this again.
No regulations on it.
The people want it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, of course, that when an organization, let's take a hospital, they have to make sure that patients are helped. And if you train, it is the waiting list will be getting longer.
Exactly.
So they're in a catch 22 actually, and that's why I think it's very complicated organizations, also the way they organize it with the surgeons. They are in their own company, they have their private company, but they hire or lease the OR, and who is then responsible and accountable? That makes it more diffuse. That's why I think it's hard.
And is there a cost aspect because they have to hire you and you're not cheap probably, or you don't do it for free at least, and that maybe comes into the equation?
No, it's very dangerous what I'm going to say now, but the thing is that if a medical specialist is hired by the hospital, not paid, not in how do you call that, paid service, but he is hired with his company, that means that when he doesn't do anything, he's not paid, right? So the thing is that if he's not, a surgeon is not operating, but he's in training with me.
Yeah, he's not getting any money.
He's not getting any money.
Yeah.
So what's the incentive?
Actually, well, then it's double, right? Because he's not getting any money. Instead, he's spending it on training.
Exactly. He will get his credits because our trainings will give them credits. But that makes it complicated.
Do you think are there still hospitals in our country that are not embracing this idea?
Yeah, it's 50-50, I heard.
So much are still unaware of this, what I always call the new gospel?
No. It's because
they're probably aware, but they don't see the necessity.
I don't know. It's financially, if you look at the financial, the way the finances go of hospitals, what I understood from boardroom members, it is so complex to see to change that or not. But I know for all the academic hospitals, the university hospitals, they have people who are on paid services, so they're on the payroll.
CRM training, you mean? Or what
no,
do you mean?
No, I mean they're on the payroll. In all hospitals,
I see.
You hire a surgeon with his company, with his group of surgeons. Yeah.
Is there a difference between university hospitals and other hospitals that they would seek to get CRM training or not be interested?
I don't know. I think university hospitals or academic hospitals, they have that more incorporated than all the other hospitals. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's easier because a boardroom can just say, okay, we want to change this organization.
Yeah.
March 1, 2, 3, 4, March, and then everybody goes that way,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, I don't know if that's the way to do it, but for the other hospitals, that's harder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We were going to talk about the timeout procedure. Is that analog to something we did in the cockpit?
Yeah, I think it's almost the same as a pre-start checklist.
Yeah.
Before engine start checklist, something like that. What we heard when we were at a hospital to talk about CRM training, they said, "Well, we already do the timeout procedure, and that made sure that 50% of our left-right mistakes were caught."
What do you mean with left-right mistakes?
A left-right mistake is like they operate on the left knee while the right knee should have been operated on.
Yeah. Okay.
When Han heard that, he really fell off his chair. He thought 50%. I mean, and then one of the board members, I think it was the medical, the chief of surgery, said, "Yeah, but we do 20,000 operations per year, so 6 left-right mistakes is not so bad."
Okay.
So the funny thing is, of course, when we would hear that, you say, "Okay, so when I make after 10 years, I landed next to the runway is okay." And that's again why I think these organizations are very complicated organizations with their stakeholders and maybe even the shareholders.
Yeah.
Because a hospital is clarified A++ when they have a 98.5% of good quality.
Yeah.
Or 97, I don't know.
Success rate.
Yeah. So, and for us, we always strive to 100%.
Exactly.
Like we always say, you cannot give one baby to the wrong parents in a hospital, or one person being sentenced to death, one mistake out of 100. It's impossible. You should always strive for.
Yeah.
So the incentive here is, again, 98.5% is okay.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the way of thinking. The philosophy is not correct when you think about it like that. So
you should aim for perfection.
100%. And you know that it's probably very hard to achieve 100%, but you should aim for 100%.
Yeah, because if you fall short, then you've made a mistake somewhere, and then basically you're accepting that you're making mistakes.
Yes, but don't forget what Sydney Decker, you know Sydney Decker,
yeah.
He says when a human error is made, it is a symptom of a fault deeper in the organization. And I totally agree with that, because you can imagine that when a guy like me, for example, I'm coming from the F-16, I can get into Martinair in 1994, and I'm used to be the king of the mountain. I'm the guy with king the silverback, right? I'm the silverback guy.
The silverback gorilla, yeah.
And Martinair likes me, right? Because he likes former military pilots, for example. I'm not saying that it's true, but in that period, let's assume that they liked it.
Oh, yeah, they Yeah, but they were also people of a very operational mindset that was aligning properly, perfectly, actually, with the company.
Yeah, but let's say then I'm there within Martinair with 40 of my colleagues, former F-16 pilots, and we are all, when the pressure gets high, we start working autonomously and being held very directive.
Yeah.
And is that a mistake of me, or is that a mistake of Martinair accepting people like me? And I think that's the whole point. When you accept certain teachers, certain surgeons, certain pilots, that's what I think what Sydney Decker means. It's a symptom of a problem deeper in the organization.
Yeah,
because
but on
you
the other hand,
you accept that culture.
Yeah, but that's, of course, you are one of the guys from the early days in that, that is deeply interested in the CRM material matter, and so you want to understand that. But I've seen, I've noticed it. I've flown with sure. F-16 former F-16 pilots, and indeed, when the pressure ran up, the you know, and it's approaching the red, then they were all of a sudden operating solo.
Yeah. Yeah,
they would grab the gear handle and throw it down while I was the pilot monitoring, supposed to do that and stuff like that. But that's not so strange. But it's not so strange.
No, but if you don't want that because you are convinced that two guys know more,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Or are better yeah. at solving the problem,
yeah.
you should teach me to stop doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
You should that's train true. Me. So that's what I mean with that's a symptom of a yeah. trouble deeper in yeah. the organization absolutely. Or in the system.
Absolutely.
So, and that's the same. You hear all these biases about surgeons, or also about the investigation that came out last week. It's the male surgeons most of the time who do this, who are very directive. It's not their fault.
No,
it is something that is accepted.
Yeah, and it's grown that
and
way.
And if you don't want that as an organization or as an industry, you need to train people.
Exactly.
And I'm not preaching for more work because we got work enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you don't train them, then they will not change.
Oh, exactly.
So
exactly.
Yeah.
That's the funny thing with the training in aviation, and you know that we got to this high standard thanks to that training. You know, in Martinair we had very high standards,
yeah.
and sometimes so high that I thought, you know, you're putting way too much training moments in a 4-hour simulator session, that it became really hectic. But the intention was really very good, and that, you know, resulted in look at I flew the MD-11 for 20 years. We had 7 MD-11s. We never put a dent or a scratch in one of them. Mm. You know, we had a situation in Heraklion, you know, the famous bump mm-hmm. hump on the numbers on the yeah. runway, and people would slam into it on the uphill part of that little hump on the runway and then bounce off. And, you know, one of them correctly actually did a balked landing.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen how many MD-11s have crashed on landing with other carriers. And not to say that we are superior, but somehow, somewhere, we did a good job,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Because it was a tricky airplane. It was a difficult, not difficult, but it was, you could never leave it out of your sight.
Yeah, that it had other margins, let's put it like
exactly,
that.
Yeah. You know. And I'm flying the 747 right now, and I'm seeing a whole different animal, but the thing is, again, relentless training. You know, years ago I heard that the estimated cost of an airline per pilot in training, spent on training for his entire career, let it be 25 or 30 years, was $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably much more these days. I would think that on the low end.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, yeah.
But it's,
I don't know if you want to go into that, but if you look at Lufthansa, their training cost versus KLM training costs in mm-hmm. KLM, it's Lufthansa is very cheap.
Really?
Yeah, because they give you 2 or 3 first officer trainings mm-hmm. courses and 2 or 3 captain, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And in KLM, you can do 12,
you
14,
can do,
which means that let's say you do 10 within KLM, 10 rate type ratings.
Mm-hmm.
That's 20 months that you're not producing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've always wondered about that.
Yeah.
You know, that was low hanging fruit. If I thought, you know, you could save the company some money.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to, you know, I don't know if you maybe you maybe yes or maybe no. I recorded with Martin, the owner of this building and company, a podcast in the 737 cockpit, and our topic was about President of Poland who mm-hmm. died in a crash in Smolensk with the was it a Tupolev? Completely unnecessary. Caused by get-home-itis, you know, and that's been my topic all along. How I think it's one of the things in the industry, get-home-itis, you know, when the captain just has completely gone nuts and all the warning signs are red, and he still presses on for making a landing. He wants to. He's like a horse smelling the stables. He wants to make that landing.
Mm-hmm.
The runway is flooded. The wind is in the wrong direction. There's lightning. There's microbursts, all sorts of bad condition, and every other airplane has diverted to a different airport, and he is still trying to land there, and it ends wrong. It often, mm-hmm. you know, I've done some digging in it, and we've seen sometimes 3 crashes a year, and not seldom that people walk away from it because it happens during the landing and the airplane skids off the runway and they're lucky, mm-hmm. but also the entire crew and passengers, they all perish. I think it's the last major threat. You know, we have all these warning or these warning systems in the airplane, you know, the ground proximity warning. We have all sorts of backups and but we have nothing. It seems we have no answer for that. What do you think?
I think
that?
There is an answer for that, and the answer is a low or shallow gradient in the cockpit. Uh-huh. Where the first officer or the second officer can say go around, and that the captain will listen. The thing is, I give you one name, Professor Job Groenewegen. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to listen to him, and he tells you why people take risks and that we are very irrational taking risks. And get home itis. The thing is, we take risks as humans as a basic necessity. Like eating food or sex, mm-hmm. whatever, right? And we are not rational in taking risks. I give you an example. There were a couple of years ago, there were 2 shark attacks in the California beach. So people did not go into the water anymore, but they drove to the beach. And per year, I think it was 1,200 people died or almost died in car accidents driving to the beach. Mm-hmm. And nobody died by shark attacks.
Yeah.
So people are not rational when you talk about taking risks. The thing is that what happened there in the cockpit, if I remember correctly, it was indeed a general pushing it. We have to land. The guy, what you mentioned, who was director of the whole ceremony next day. You have to be very upward in that culture and upfront to say no.
Exactly.
We heard stories about our former boss, the big CEO, mm-hmm. who said, do not turn the seatbelt signs on because I want to talk to my business relationships. Mm-hmm. And the Dutch culture said, I'm sorry, sir, but who's flying, you or me?
Exactly.
And he turned the seatbelt sign on. Yeah. So there also culture doesn't help. But of course, I think that I also heard in the bar maybe, I heard guys say, well, I have to be warned when I'm in Miami and I'm on my 11th day of my roster and I have a slight headache. It is always less headache than what I had in Holland when I departed. So, if you have a headache and you have to go flying away from home.
Yeah, exactly. I see what
you
mean.
So the headache becomes much worse.
You smell the stables. The headache is not so bad anymore.
And I think that is an emotion that's why you need somebody next to you in a psychological safe environment who says, hey, but guy, if you have a headache, let's just delay it 12 hours and get another pilot here and you sit in the back. Mm-hmm. My pilots never believed that I said, I will not fly with a headache, also not from Miami. I will not do it. And I think it's also example behavior that you have to show as a captain, but also as a manager or as a chief pilot. Mm-hmm. So that helps.
Yeah, but you have to know where your principles lie beforehand. You know, if you are making the plan up as you go along, you're probably going to make a decision for pressing on.
Yes,
because you are smelling the stables. You want to go home.
Yeah,
and you should have considered that beforehand. You know, the opt out.
Yes, but that's also something that I think that has to be done within the organization. So we know planes have crashed or helicopters have crashed in search and rescue missions. And why? Probably also because they heard that the patient was in critical condition and they pushed the limits to save the people, right?
Yeah.
Or to save that victim.
Yeah.
So that's why you have to have very good norms and agreements on how fast you will go, how long you will continue. Yeah. And that has to be the rule, because otherwise you cannot speak to each other about breaking the rules or not. If you don't have rules, I would say if you feel a slight headache, for us the rule is if you take a paracetamol, you have to report it, right? Mm-hmm. Does everybody do that? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Does everybody who takes a paracetamol when he has to go into surgery? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Because we think that we are still good enough and we have to do that for the patient, for the passenger, my baby, for my kids, whatever. As an organization, you need to know that people will take risks. And if you don't want them to take risks, you have to make sure that you can mitigate it.
Mm-hmm. You also trained commanders from a fire brigade, right?
Yes. Yeah.
how, you know, the thing is, we are discussing right now about this search and rescue helicopter where they are completely focused on saving the patient and actually ended up killing themselves because they were in such a rush. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always bad to rush, but how did that work with the fire brigade? You know, when they are going somewhere with the lights and the sirens howling, and they have protocols for that.
Yeah, they also have protocol, and I know when we started training them, and now I don't know the numbers exactly anymore, but they went from a 6 crew to a 4th crew. Yeah, so two people were
on a truck.
Yeah, on a truck. What I remember from those guys, they said there's a big difference between voluntary fire brigade or a professional. Why? Because in their jobs, they have a lot of false alarms. So they drive away to somewhere and they think, okay, now we can do something. Yeah. It's a false alarm. Go back.
Yeah.
When you're a professional, you're used to that.
Yeah.
But when you volunteer once every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and those guys take sometimes extra risks. So if you know that as a safety region, as we call it in the Netherlands, you have to train and give those insights.
Yeah.
And then give the guy lowest in hierarchy also the authority to say, hey guys, what did they tell us in training?
We should step on the brake.
Step on the brake because this house is going to be torn down anyway, so let it burn down. Mm-hmm. It's no problem.
Yeah.
Because that's what happened, I think, 5-6 years ago in Groningen somewhere.
Yeah.
They went into a house to extinguish the fire while it was...
Was a wreck.
2 weeks later, it was a wreck anyway. Yeah. They would tear it down,
and
one guy died there.
Oh, shit.
So again, that means you need to have training to know that people will take those risks.
Yeah, exactly.
If I ask here, let's say it's 20 people here, I say, "Do you text? Is texting in the car while driving dangerous?" 85% says yes, and you ask those 85%, "Do you text in the car?" And then 60% says yes.
Yeah.
So you need to give more insights and then a psychological safe environment, and then you will tell me, JP, don't text in the car.
Yeah.
And then I say, you're right.
Yeah. Hey, another thing back again, because I find it a majorly interesting topic, operating theater. They started with using checklists, right?
In the ORs, you mean in hospitals?
In the ORs,
yes.
They started using checklists.
Yeah.
That was also seen as, you know, I remember when we were in Martinair years ago, when I was started as a first officer, I was taking part in a committee, and we always noticed that certain repeated mistakes were made by people in operations, and we told them, start using a checklist, and then they guffawed and they said, like, come on, man, I mean... My brain is not that faulty that I need a checklist. You bunch of wimps, you use checklists. We don't. We don't need to. Eventually, they started using it. Wasn't that the same process in an OR?
I think so. Yes, it was a little
ahead of my time, but
no, they. You know, the way we approach it with the S human factors, you talk about three things. It's about we use the Shell model, SHAL.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we talk about means, methods. And people, right? So it's three. It has to do with three aspects, and we are talking about supporting means, supporting procedures and checklists, and liveware to liveware, people to people.
Yeah.
And the team makes the decision, and the rest is supporting. That's why they changed our checklist, the emergency checklist. All main manufacturers. In the addendum before the checklist, the preamble, it says Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Airbus, we cannot construct checklists for any conceivable information, so it's always commander's or crew's decision.
Yeah.
And that has everything to do. You give the best instruments, the best checklists, but still there might be a situation where two situations happen at the same time, or just shortly after each other, and then you need to start thinking CRM or become creative.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old days, we weren't allowed to be creative.
No.
Before Tenerife, it was there a technical problem? No. Did they follow the checklist? Yes. Pilot error.
Yeah.
And that was the simple deduction they always used to do. And the thing is, what Just Culture brought us and CRM brought, that I know for sure that before Tenerife, there have been similar situations, but they didn't end up in a catastrophe, 583 people dying.
Mm-hmm.
So, but nobody reported it. So no. We needed a just culture before that.
Yeah, exactly.
And nobody did, because no. Somebody said, yeah, if I'm going to tell them that I almost ran into another aircraft on the runway, mm-hmm. they're going to fire my butt.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, you look at those three things, methods, means, and people. Mm-hmm. And the other two are supporting. You can have the best early warning indicators in software and hardware, but it still comes down to keep thinking and use team intelligence.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you can only do that in a just culture.
That's true. I always said that, you know, just culture is that umbrella under which that CRM functions.
Yes.
And otherwise it doesn't.
Yeah.
It will, you know, I've seen companies where they talk the talk, but they didn't walk the talk, you know.
Yeah.
They had their all their lectures were full of the nice intentions of CRM, but then eventually, because there was just culture was not there yet, mm-hmm. it was basically you put the horse behind the cart, you know, it's not going anywhere. But anyway, but I wanted to kind of slowly wrap it up here because we could talk on this for hours,
yeah,
right?
And
it's majorly interesting to talk to you, JP. Thanks so much for coming here. And we're going to do this again, and then we're going to sit down with Martin. Martin records a lot of YouTube clips with Martin Schaap, where he gets into the psychology of sales training and everything. And he is also one guy that, you know, can tell a lot about that, the human workings of the brain, or weaknesses or strengths. And like I said, we could go on for hours, but we will devote another podcast in the future to this. So Jean-Pierre Kalman, thank you very much for being here.
It was great fun.
Yeah, it was. It was. I really loved it. And there are many more questions to ask, but we will save them for another time. Merry Christmas, man. Thanks for being here.
You too.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, all the best. Thank you.